Espresso Cincinnati. Hi, everybody. I'm back here today with my co-host, Burl Love. Special guest today is, honestly, it's something hard for me to wrap my head around. New prosecutor, Melissa Powers, is our special guest today, and I'm not surprised that it's her. It's just hard to imagine covering the prosecutor's office without Joe Dieters in the seat.
And so, I know what you mean. It's like when you say the words Hamilton County prosecutor, your brain and your mouth automatically want to just say Joe Dieters, because that's how it's been for so long. And he's been the face of the prosecutor's office and a very public facing orienting type of prosecutor, not afraid of cameras or to make bold statements. So yes, it is tough to wrap your mind around that.
So I'm looking forward to talking to her today. We're going to talk about the politics of all the things, and really we're going to focus a little bit on the politics today. Kevin Grasha, the courts reporter at the Inquirer, is like busy writing a personality profile on her and letting us know like how she came, like her whole like background story and, you know, what makes the woman. But there's such a political angle to everything too, which I think is a specialty of this podcast. Yes, Burl?
No, I think that'll be fun to dig into. You know, she was sort of her honeymoon period was very brief. There wasn't a lot of time for her to kind of keep a low profile and you know, get her office set up and you know, the kind of things you would do when you take over an office before she had to deal with a very high profile police shooting in Wyoming.
She had a big press conference last Friday, and I have to say, you know, people were watching. They were watching. I mean, the Wyoming case was like, what happened there? There was a lot of questions to be answered by her office. I did feel like she put together a very thorough report and a lot came out all at once.
No, but I think people were watching to see how she handled it. I know,
100%. My phone was blowing up.
Like, I know, like, from our watching end. You mentioned Kevin's working on a proper introductory profile for her, but because of that high profile situation, she was trending in search. And so we had Kevin kind of turn out a very quick kind of mini pre-profile, three things you might not know about her or three things to know about her. And I think it was a nice snapshot. And I think people will be curious to read more about her and also hear her talk today in her own words about, you know, her journey to, you know, I would say, you know, she's got the qualifications. This might be a position that she inadvertently has been preparing for a long time, or maybe she was intentional about it. But I think it'll be nice to hear her in her own words talk about how she sees, you know, the future of the prosecutor's office and what she's going to bring to the job.
And so my answer to everyone was, are you watching? Was no, I'm not. I'm writing about the Citizen Complaint Authority report that dropped kind of as a surprise Thursday night. And I don't know if anybody's heard there. Joe Mixon was arrested and then unarrested. So I was very busy on Thursday and Friday while the rest of my coworkers were covering the Wyoming.
Now, is it accurate to say he was arrested and unarrested? Maybe that he was
charged and uncharged.
Yeah, a warrant was issued and then because of charges and then dropped.
That is, yes, we need to be very careful about that, honestly.
Very careful from a legal standpoint. So yeah, a couple big stories to talk about. Let's since we're talking about Mixon, let's just talk about that very quickly. You of course were part of the coverage of that story, a very, I want to say, bizarre story, because of how it went down. So can you summarize it in case our listeners didn't read it? Let's give them a quick summary and then we can talk about what might happen next.
Joe Mixon on Thursday was accused, charges were filed accusing him of an aggravated menacing dating back to January 21st for what is described in reports as a road rage incident at 2nd and Walnut Streets. And I mean, people were just stunned. And it was a national, like, super quick viral national story, speaking of trending on Twitter. But that really was like what happened. I basically stayed up all night on Thursday night trying to figure everything out. And by Friday morning, the prosecutor's office, you can't just issue a warrant and charges and then be like, oopsie, no, there's a process. And the prosecutor went into a judge and said, we need to dismiss this case. And they didn't give like a whole lot of reasons why. A judge agreed. But they said, as a tepid aside, the person who filed the complaint still wants to go forward with this case and we might refile charges. And I have never seen anything like this.
Like, so there's, that brings up a lot of things we have to unpack. First of all, from a NFL/Bengals standpoint, this has been an ongoing issue, a challenge for them when players get arrested for any type of assault. It's just been one of those things where they've tried to put policies in place. The NFL has tried to, you know, clean up its image. And the Bengals, I would say, you know, coming in off another incredible season, this is the last thing they wanted to deal with, a player accused of an assault.
I mean, it was shocking because it's just been so long. This is a whole new team. It's not just a whole new winning team. It's a whole new culture. You know, Joe Burrow is the Cincinnati hero. He's so wholesome and like he's from Athens, and there's this whole new narrative, and it really, it's like a true narrative. Like, you, when you see these players, they're friends, they go golfing together, Joe Burrow's buying them a cruise. Like, this is a new culture there. This came out of the total blue, and so
it happened, just to establish the timeline, it happened the day before the team traveled to Buffalo for the divisional playoff, and so because of the NFL's image concerns, because of the Bengals wanting to, avoid controversies like this, we've had the undoubtable claims that he might have been given special treatment.
Well, shocking, bro. I'm working on a story about that right now.
What's your take on that? I mean, everyone's innocent until they're proven guilty. But then, you know, there's wisdom to the old adage, where there's smoke, there's fire. So obviously something happened.
Agree. I mean, I've seen the report. It describes, you know, the woman came into the police department. She was afraid. She was clearly very upset. The timeline of when she said it happened, she makes a report right after. It is, you know, that fits the time frame of when Joe Mixon was going to the stadium to leave for Buffalo. So,
and just so we're clear too, there's no evidence that there was an actual physical assault. It was a threatening. She claims that she was threatened with a pistol.
Correct. And so, but did he get special treatment? There's no protocol. So I've been through the police procedure and manual. I haven't looked at this in a while. So that was like, I was falling down a rabbit hole there. There is a very specific procedure for high profile incidents, like things that you would think, right? A police involved shooting, somebody's killed, like things you would think, definitely. But there's no protocol for what to do if it's a high profile individual. Now, the police department released late Friday a press release calling Joe Mixon a high profile individual, leading to all of these questions. Was there special treatment? That's where this is coming from. That one phrase in a press release, and it did catch my attention because I had never heard of this. It's human nature to be like, of course, high profile individuals are going to get more attention. Because, like, you just don't willy-nilly do things and not tell your bosses if somebody everyone knows is, you know, a part of an investigation. So, of course, there's something like that. But he was charged, and the narrative now is, what's the evidence, right? Like they said, the investigating officer didn't do, you know, a good enough job, and it had to be reassigned. So it's reassigned to a new investigator who's starting from scratch, you know, interviewing the woman, probably looking at videos and doing that. And is that special treatment because it's him, or is they don't have enough evidence and they are doing what's right and what they should do with any person? But I think the question then becomes, do they do that with any person?
Right.
So I'm still working on that story, but that's a little bit of like kind of the thing that I'm seeing with this case.
Right. And I think we haven't seen, you know, the final act in this drama. We're kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop. Will, you know, if the woman decides to go ahead and press charges, what will their action be? And then, you know, there's also the question is, what will the Bengals do? Independent of this happening, they have a salary cap. He's coming off, outside of the playoffs, he's coming off of a pretty lackluster season for the Bengals' premier running back. And it's, you know, will, if they were on the fence about him, the Bengals, is this the, you know, is this incident going to cause them to say, well, we're just going to move on and cut him loose and just
fall where they may? I've talked to Kelsey Conway, our Bengals reporter, a lot in the last few days. I don't know if anybody listened to last week's episode, but Kelsey was going to take down her Christmas decorate. Literally, we recorded this last Wednesday. Kelsey was like, I'm going on vacation on Thursday. I'm going to take down my Christmas decorations. I need to take a little rest before like this crazy offseason of player changes and Joe Burrow contracts. And she is in for it. She is.
No rest for the weary.
She has not been off. So I was talking to her. So the thing, honestly, when I'm writing a story, like, did Joe Mixon get special treatment? And that's a very hard question to answer. This, to me, like looking at him, is this is such a cloud now. Either way, if he gets cut, did he get cut because of this? If they keep him, did they keep him because they had to do it because of this? Like, there's just so much now that's going to be hanging out there because of this very convoluted case and how it's unfolding. And again, I've never seen something like this. 20 years, I covered courts, I covered police, and I covered the city. And it's like, what happened here?
Well, we have a lot of coverage. We also have Jason Williams, former host of this podcast, our sports columnist. He weighed in on it, you know, saying that this is going to be a moment where the Bengals are going to be evaluated on what kind of team, what kind of image, what are their values, what do they stand for? Is, you know, quote unquote, new day, DEY, is it real, or is it just, you know, a marketing slogan? So a lot to happen here.
I want to say one thing as we end this conversation and maybe move on to Kareem is our producer today. He's going to tell us about timing, but I do want to leave it on this. Joe Mixon says he didn't do this. I do think that's very important for us to say. We have, no one's talked to him directly, but his agent, who's a lawyer, says that he didn't do this. And I think that's an overarching thing here, as everyone tries to decide what's going on, that's what he says.
That's absolutely right. I mean, we just don't know. That's why I think it's going to be very interesting to watch how this moves forward. We were talking about his spot on the team. He might have been cut regardless of this. So much more drama to unfold here. I think, you know, what you said is very important. He is saying that he didn't do anything wrong. But I think just to tell the complete story, we also have to mention that he had an incident as a college player where he was caught on video punching a woman. Now, he's worked really hard to move forward from that. Many have said he's paid the price for that and he's moved forward, and that shouldn't be, you know, weighed into this situation. But just to paint the full picture for everybody, very complex. And then also very, I'll say it again, very bizarre how it's unfolded, to have charges, a warrant actually dropped with the woman who's accusing him saying that she might continue to press charges. It's a very unusual situation, you know, complicated by the fact you're dealing with a high profile person in town. So let's shift gears, shall we?
all of this happened at one time. The Citizens Complaint Authority. I have to say, from time to time, the Citizens Complaint Authority, this is no secret. I write about this all the time. It's underfunded. They're behind. They're like 2 years behind on doing investigations. And this is part of the collaborative agreement. This is part of how policing goes in the city. An independent oversight board is supposed to be doing the work. If you don't pay, if you don't have enough money and you don't have enough investigators, guess what happens? You fall super behind.
Well, so, and then again, for our listeners, just let me give the like two sentence background. The Citizens Complaint Authority was one of the results of a fatal police shooting of a young man named Timothy Thomas in 2001. National headlines. For a while, there was a federal oversight panel put in place to deal with police reform in Cincinnati and community policing and putting trust back into the institution of the police department. And it became a model nationally for other cities who were facing, you know, similar problems. And so we have this Citizens Complaint Authority. It still meets to review, as the name implies, complaints that citizens file about their interactions with police. And we had a big story drop this week because
it was
I pitch it back to you.
It was the report on what happened during the 2020 Cincinnati protests related to the injustice of George Floyd's death in Minneapolis. This is 4 days of protests and then some other, you know, follow-ups, the meetings where there's big crowds turned out, where they're talking about policing and how policing is done here too. And we've been waiting for this. There were just tons of, there was almost 500 arrests. Now the Citizens Complaint Authority on the whole didn't really look at like every arrest, like who filed complaints that there are, you know, there was police misconduct in there while they were, you know, protesting. And so they ended up, the outcome of that was they ended up with, I think, 14. I wrote this. I know you think I would totally know the number.
I think I can remember there was more than 50 complaints that they investigated, and they determined that of those 54 complaints, 14 had merit.
Which is not to say that the other ones didn't have merit. You know, it's very chaotic. They did, for a lot of the things, they didn't have evidence. And this, I do have to say, these investigations on the whole are so thorough. Because I read the reports, just, you know, we don't cover it maybe as much as we should. Trust me, if anything, I read these reports every single month. If anything was like really rose to the level of, I can't believe we didn't know this, excessive force that, you know, really affected all the citizens of Cincinnati, I would make sure that got done. But I read these reports every month. They're very thorough. They talk to everybody involved. And this report, going back to these protests, it's 166 pages. I've never seen something more thorough come out of City Hall. The timeline that they put together of what happened in 2020 in those very chaotic nights is really incredible. So it's a timeline of how everything happened, like hour by hour in some cases, and then where the complainant fits in to that timeline. My joke has been, because we've talked about it on this podcast, that the audit into the development deals, which I'm still looking at, you guys haven't forgotten that wasn't done. I'm like, maybe the CCA should do that report. Because this was just incredible work. A lot of recommendations have come out of this. And, you know, we didn't see anything that was, you know, they found problems. One of the major outcomes of this is we already know there shouldn't have been a curfew. A judge ruled that was unconstitutional and that the police shouldn't have really used these mass arrests on minor charges. Taking people off the streets is really the way to handle these protests because it ended up making things like a little bit worse. So they're in the process now of reading these things publicly, in which then the city manager will have to make a decision. Are these things sustained? And are the recommendations something that this police department is going to implement? Now, so we have this report. It gets dropped on Thursday night, kind of in a weird way, fine, whatever. Then we roll into Monday night for the public reading of these charges and what's happening and how this all came together. And they're like, oopsie, we're out of time. You don't say. Like, it's a 166-page report. Like, who thought we were getting through this in one, you know, one, like, two-hour night meeting? Like, this is very important of, you know, how we handle these things. Just recently, I'm talking to the mayor, right? And he had his own kerfuffle. We talked about it last week. But he spent the day. So he had that kerfuffle with everything with Kansas City, made that kind of weird proclamation. He did spend the rest of that day with our police department talking to them about how they would handle protests should protests happen in the wake of what happened in Memphis with the death there. Now, we didn't end up really having any protests that night, but this could happen at any single incident, any single night. And so what the Cincinnati Police Department and how they handle it, like in the wake of this report and their findings, that needs to be read now and handled now and let's go. Because what if it happens again? And it can't it has to be handled immediately, in my opinion. You're right.
I think you're right. But I think just having this report, you know, new police chief Teresa Thigee has had to respond to questions about it. You know, the police are obviously going to defend their own and their decisions. And there's a lot of gray area here. Let's be honest. You know, they're trying to keep people safe. They're trying to keep property safe. There's sometimes a fine line, like a tipping point between a peaceful protest and things getting out of hand. So, you know, it's a tough job that they do. And I think we have to acknowledge that. But just the fact that we have this report, that we're talking about it, that the police have had to respond, I think keeps things in check. You know, it's a reminder that they have to not exacerbate situations. You know, I want to remind our listeners, and then I think we're running long, Sherry, because it's just I've looked at the clock. There's a lot to talk about here.
I guess I have feelings about things.
But in case people forgot, one of our own reporters was detained and you know, cuffed with zip ties briefly. Because he was simply trying to reconnect with the group that he was with. He had got separated from the photographer and another reporter, and he was waiting where the police, you know, waiting while the police were trying to get the crowd moved up the street. And then he was confused about where he could stand and where he couldn't, according to police officers' directions. And as he was trying to rejoin the group of other reporters, he got taken down. There's video of it. And, you know, was that excessive? Absolutely it was, you know, and that was just a reporter. And we made a big deal of that because it's our reporter. That led to meaningful discussions with the leadership at the time. They've had some turnover since then about how to engage members of the press and how detaining members of the press should be an absolute last resort. I think we can look back at the George Floyd related protest and see a lot of opportunities for, you know, learning, communicating, making sure, like you said, that we're prepared for the next time that we are going to have, you know, whether you want to call it civil unrest, whether you want to call it peaceful protesting, where's the line between it? Doesn't matter. Law enforcement has to be prepared. They have to have training. They have to have policies that they adhere to minimize things getting out of hand. So anyway, I think everything you said about the CCA, the Citizens Complaint Authority, about, you know, it being underfunded, sometimes how quickly we can forget sometimes. I think it's important that we maintain that group, that we fund that group. It's an important group. But I think just the fact that we have this report and we're talking about it is an important aspect to this in and of itself.
And that they did a great job on the report.
Well, I didn't read the whole thing like you did. So
it did not leave any questions. Like, you're reading it and you're like, oh, well, what about this? And then they would either answer the question that you have in your head as you're reading it, or they would say, we don't have enough information to answer the question that you're thinking in your head as you're reading this. Like, I was really impressed.
So more to come on that.
All
All right.
So let's talk some politics, huh?
All right.
Special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati. And I want to correct something that I said earlier. I said new Hamilton County Prosecutor Melissa Powers, but what I really meant was Hamilton County Prosecutor Melissa Powers. I don't know. Am I right to take that new off? I feel like you've been hard at work already.
We have been hard at work. I've hit the ground running. It's been a complete marathon since day one. I'm so excited to be here and to be back in the office. As you know, I was a prosecutor, an assistant prosecutor back in 1991, right out of law school. I was here for about 8 years before I left and went into private practice. So, but yes, prosecuting attorney, that's who I am.
So we are going to leave, like a lot of times on this podcast, we talk about people's backgrounds and everything, but I do feel like we have such a crossover with the Inquirer and Cincinnati.com. Kevin Grasha, our courts reporter, did he spend a day with you?
I don't think it was a day, but he did spend a good portion of a morning with me. Yes.
Okay. Cause I texted him during that. And so he's going to write, you know, really, I know that he did that in-depth interview with you. We're going to leave him to really talk about your background. I wanted to talk a little bit of the politics of this, and start by, you know, how you did come to this job, because it is such a big political job in Hamilton County. I mean, every county is not the same, but in this county, this is the political job. It just is. I mean, partly I think it was Joe Dieter's, you know, personality made it that way, but I'm certain that that's not going to change. And had this long been, how did you come to this?
Well, I grew up in Cincinnati, Hamilton County. I absolutely love the city. I've been serving the community for the past 31 years. I retired as the administrative judge for juvenile court, and my retirement lasted 23 days. So never in my wildest dreams did I ever think Joe would be leaving the office or there'd be a vacancy here to run the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office. But I started my career here. I absolutely loved working here. A lot of the people that I worked alongside with are still in the office. A lot of the prosecutors appeared before me in my 17 years as a judge. And so I'm very familiar with the office. So when the vacancy was being announced, I was interested and spoke to, I guess, some of the people at the Republican Party, the chairman at the time, expressed an interest. But my goal here is I believe I can make a difference. I love our city, and I'd like to see that the prosecutor's office remains an institution of law and order, where public safety is paramount, because I believe that's critical to keeping the city that I love a safe place, a wonderful place to live, to work, to start a business, to raise a family.
How did it come about? So I know, I think that Joe leaving was a huge surprise, and obviously he knew before we really all kind of knew publicly. So did you make the decision to retire from being a juvenile court judge with the idea that you were just retiring from that job, or did you already know that this could be a possibility?
No, I had to make the decision well over a year ago that I was retiring as a juvenile court judge after serving 31 years. So that decision was made well in advance of ever having any inkling that Joe may receive an appointment from the governor. Joe's appointment to the Supreme Court occurred after the election. So after the governor's race, after the chief justice race, where they created a vacancy on the Supreme Court, that was well after the election.
So, I mean, how long did you kind of know? What was the time window between, well, this job is open, and for you to say you were going to apply through the application process?
Well, I had to have some very good conversations with my family, with my husband, And whether, because we had made plans my plan was to enjoy my four grandchildren, to spend more time traveling, and to pursue my interest. I'm a painter, an oil painter, and to pursue being an artist. Those were my plans. So when this obviously had to make some serious thought and whether or not this was the right thing for me at this point in my life, and then also the right thing for my family. So I would say about 3 weeks before I actually made the commitment that I would be interested in running. But my thought and in my heart was that I know I can make a difference. I know I can do a good job. And I felt that I was the best candidate to do that and the best option. And I felt that with Cincinnati, I really am concerned about this office not pursuing and remaining, being tough on violent crime. We've seen what was been going on across the country and other cities where it was soft on crime and people were not being held accountable. And how it changed and made cities go into some sort of decline, chaos, lawlessness. I mean, we've been watching it nationally, and that's something I did not want to have happen here. And so I really, truly believe I can make a difference and I'm the right person to be here.
I mean, it is a huge life decision. Like, this is definitely not a 9-to-5 job. And I can tell you, over the last 20 years, I think it's been on more than one occasion when I've called Joe Dieters on vacation. One time he was in Europe. Oh. And I was like, you didn't have to answer, but it's a 24-hour day job.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, it is a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week job, and it's a lot of responsibility, but it's an important job, and somebody with my experience, I believe, needs to be here, somebody that has the experience has the experience in many different aspects. I've done public defender work. I was a prosecutor. I was a judge. I'm a mother. I'm a grandmother. I've lived here all my life. All of these things factor into, obviously, my qualifications, I think, and which makes me uniquely positioned to be the best person to run this, besides Joe. I think Joe did a fabulous job, and this office, and under his leadership, is the main reason Cincinnati is still a great place to live and people want to live here.
Did he give you any advice?
His advice was to have courage to do the right thing, which is what I've always lived by throughout my career. Also his advice was to tell the truth and to be fair and to be honest. And again, those are all things that I've already have used it throughout my entire career.
So when you decided that you were going to take this job, knowing that it's 2 years, right? Like, you're filling the rest of the term, right? That he was supposed to serve out. How much did it factor in that you were going to have to run for a high profile election? Like, running for judge, unfortunately, with like the way the media landscape is, it's just not as high scrutiny as running for prosecutor. I mean, how much did you factor that in to how you would take this job?
Well, it was a consideration that was hand in hand with the decision of taking the job. I'm not taking the job just to do 2 years. I'm taking the job to win in 2 years. You're right. It is a high profile job. I'm much more in the public eye than I am or was ever as a judge. A judge, on occasion, you would have a case that might get some media attention. But this is definitely, the decision making is stops with me as the prosecutor. And while it's similar to being a judge, again, it's not setting the tone for the city. It's just handling it case by case. This is actually setting this to tone and standard, supporting law enforcement, making sure that this office stays law and order.
So much has been made of this county is, you know, bluer and bluer. And we've definitely seen that at the courthouse. There's just, when I came, with all Republican judges and like one Democrat judge. And, you know, it has really shifted. City council only run Republican. So Are you already ramping up to run?
Yes, already making the consideration and forecasting out in the future, in 2 years, what the campaign will look like. And so we'll continue to work on that. I realized the demographics in the county has changed dramatically since when I began my career. And so that's something that you think about. I still think I'm an excellent candidate. I think that when you're dealing with public safety, it doesn't matter what your political beliefs are. So that you're still, regardless, I think people want to remain safe. They want to if you're a victim of a crime, you want that person to be held accountable. I've also been successful in a number of judicial races. I think it's somewhere around 4. Okay. So they're giving me some information about my success in my judicial races. So the last presidential race I did run in a presidential race and was successful and got, I think, roughly 60% of the vote there. But again, it's a judicial race versus the high profile Hamilton County prosecutor's race. So I know there's challenges in front of me. I'm not afraid of those challenges. I think I can rise to the occasion there. I'm a fierce candidate on the campaign trail with an incredible work ethic when it comes to that. And I think I'll be a formidable opponent to whoever the Democratic Party puts together up against me.
Oh, I definitely agree. I mean, I've had these conversations a lot because the people who are being considered on the Democratic side run in like City Hall circles of what I cover. And this is like, people are already talking about this race. And I definitely think of all the races, the Democrats are the most worried about this one.
Okay. Well, hopefully it's because I'm here. That's what I'm hoping. I have a good track record on the campaign trail. I also think that my resume, my background, my experience, I don't think anybody's going to be able to come close to meeting my experience. This job takes experience. You need to know who that you can give second chances to for rehabilitation, try to support, divert out, and who that needs to be put behind bars to keep the community safe. It's a strong balance that you need to strike. And if you don't have that experience, you don't know. And we've witnessed it in a number of the decisions that are being made throughout the county. Those without experience do not make good decisions, likely. Or I shouldn't say don't, maybe sometimes don't make the right decisions.
You know, definitely not the kind of job where you have a learning curve. Like, you need to understand it going in. So you have, are you counting that the days of like what day you are on the job already? It's not been that many.
No, but I did count how many days I was retired. It was 23.
Oh my goodness.
By now, I don't even, it's been such a whirlwind. I mean, really a marathon with a lot going on. A lot of balls up in the air, so to speak. And there's been also some major cases that required a lot of attention in my short tenure here. So I don't sometimes know even the day of the week at this point. So counting days, no, I have not. I know it's been moving very, very fast.
What is your relationship like? Are you kind of getting to know like the mayor and Sheriff McGuffey and Chief Fiji? Like, how is that going?
Well, we have on my schedule meetings planned with all the major players, I guess is the best way to phrase it, in the city. So far, I've met with McGuffey. I've also have on the books to meet with the captain, or excuse me, the chief, Teague, and I've met with the coroner. And plan to hopefully to have a conversation with the mayor, but it's also business throughout the community. And I've met with every employee of the prosecutor's office, so that's been involved as well. I'm trying to think what else I've done, but those are the meetings. A lot of meetings to make sure people know who I am and my partnership with them.
You know, it just jumped out at me as you were talking. The women that you mentioned, right? The first female chief, the first female sheriff, right. The first female prosecutor, right? Like this is amazing. This is amazing. Like that's, this is That was quite like a little conversation there. I love hearing that. And we have three female Hamilton County commissioners too.
I think it's remarkable that so many women now are having the highest positions, especially in law enforcement. And it's exciting time, I believe, for all women in Hamilton County. If we've been noticing that there's a lot of women, female judges, female prosecutors, and positions that are supervisory or team leader type of positions. So I think it's really a neat time in everybody's lives, basically, that we have so much to offer to the county.
Well, it's certainly going to be interesting to watch it all unfold. This was such a great conversation. Thank you for spending so much time with the Inquirer this week, myself and Kevin.
Thank you, Sherry. Thank you very much.
All right. You know what? Joe was our most, our guest that would come on the most of anybody. So I feel like I'll talk to you again soon.
Oh, that'll be great. I look forward to it. I
Have
really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Take Bye. Care. Me, that was kind of a blast from the past of like talking to her. I've known her for so long, and it's a whole new era, honestly. I think that's kind of where we're at.
I think you're right.
So anyone who's talked to me, I've been working, but I have been so sick. Like last week, did you guys notice I hardly asked any questions because no one wanted to hear me cough and blow my nose? So I think, Burl, you have our moment of the week because I've been super boring.
Well, I think getting that winter cold for many people, unfortunately, is a Cincinnati moment. You just can't avoid it. At some point, no matter how much hand washing you do, and if you're still wearing masks or if you're all vaccinated, you're just going to get that Cincinnati winter croup. It's just inevitable. But all right, so here's my Cincinnati moment. For years, I can't count how many times I have driven by what's now known as Swartz's Point, the jazz club right at the corner of McMicken and Vine. And when I say corner, it's one of those beautiful, like triangular built old downtown buildings. You see them in older cities where instead of the street corner, the intersection being at right angles, it comes in at a tight V and they stick a building in there. And I remember like early in my career when I was still a student at UC and I was interning at the Cincinnati Post, driving up Vine Street home back to Clifton, driving by this building, thinking, what a cool building. It's now known as Swartz's Point. If you go there on the weekends, you can see some amazing jazz. And after all these years driving by it, wanting to go see some jazz there, Lauren and I went. She has kind of like a bucket list of like when we don't know what to do on the weekend, like, what are we going to do? She has a list ready. And she's like, well, how about jazz at Swartz's Point? And I was like, all right, we're there. And we went in and saw this amazing performer. His name is Irwin Stuckey. He teaches jazz at NKU, and he is a master on the vibraphone. He was amazing. I couldn't believe I was seeing somebody so incredibly talented for a $5 cover in an intimate setting. The place is small, and the only table left when we walked in and we had a reservation, which I recommend getting, was right up in front of the stage. Lauren was literally sitting next to the vibraphone. And it was, when I say like we were transcended, it was like incredible. It was a trio. He had a guy playing upright bass that teaches at, I forget where he tells me he teaches, but by day he's a music teacher. I teaches at St. Ignatius, one through or K through eight music. And he was playing upright bass. And then they had this drummer kind of like in the corner. And these guys were in the zone. And Irwin was like going all over the place. And they were just trying to keep up. And he would just look at them in the, after this like kind of like improvised solo. And they were looking at him like, oh, my gosh, where are we? How are we going to come in? And he would scream like F, you know, like I'm in key of F right now. And then nod and they would be like right back into the, you know, to the more structured part of the piece. And so highly recommend it. I can't believe I waited so long to get there because I love seeing live music. So check out Swartz's Point Jazz Club. Google Erwin Stuckey, E-R-W-I-N, and read about him. I can't believe I waited so long to go there.
All right. What time did you go?
We got there about 9:30.
Okay. And what is the bar vibe like?
The bar vibe is really cool. It's not, you know, some jazz clubs, not that I go to a lot of them, are, I don't want to say pretentious, but like, you know, it's kind of like, this is all about the performers and everybody has to be quiet. And, you know, if you're not used to going to jazz clubs, they might be a little off-putting. This place was super welcoming, nice bar, nice, you know, I should have done a little research and figured out like who some of the key players are there, but very welcoming, very comfortable. You can, you know, there's seating at the bar. You can go up to the bar. They have table service as well. Some fun cocktails. You can get some, you know, they got some snacks and things to eat if you're hungry. But very, you know, how I would describe a jazz club in Cincinnati. It's still Cincinnati. It's still friendly. It's still welcoming. It's definitely a place to go if you've ever thought about going to a jazz club and you weren't sure about it. You will not feel out of place there. The crowd is super diverse, old, young. You know, there was this stereotypical guy in a black turtleneck standing against the wall, snapping his fingers, you know, looking oh so the hipster. And then there were like a group of people that looked like moms from the suburbs out having a great time. So
that is so Cincinnati. I love it. And we're going to do this.
I give it two thumbs up.
Alex loves jazz. I'm the planner in the household. I'm a terrible wife because we've never been there and he loves jazz. So,
well, the four of us should go sometime. We should, you know, grab a bite to eat downtown and then head there around 9:30 or 10 for the last couple of sets of whoever's playing. And, you know, and maybe I just went there on a good night, seeing a great, you know,
I know I've heard good trio. Things. Honestly, it's, what I need is a list like Lauren's, to be honest, because then I forget about things. But I have only ever heard really good things about it. So,
well, I want to go back. I thought it was fantastic. And again, when I say intimate, like if Lauren would have gotten up from her chair during the performance, she might have knocked over the vibraphone, which is so cool because not to drag this out, but where I was sitting, you know, I've seen people play the vibraphone. I'm kind of aware of that instrument, but I could actually like see into the vibraphone, see the, you know, there's these things that spin around so that the sound sustains. And I was watching how he was controlling all of this with the pedals. And, you know, he's got two mallets in each fist, right? And just all over this vibraphone with such precision. And he was like scatting quietly while he was playing, kind of like other, he went on this amazing like run with the mallets and he paused for a minute and he was scatting what I can only imagine would have been like the trumpet part to the piece they were playing or the sax part to the piece they were playing very briefly before he got back into it. I love watching musical performers in the zone. And this guy, Erwin Stuckey, he was like in the zone so deep. It didn't matter what was going on in the room. And it was just a joy to watch.
And you could tell just the way you're talking about it. I love it. All right, you guys. Maybe I'll do something fun this week. We'll see. All right. Thanks for listening, as always.
All right.